Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer, as always, is Bette Marston. I believe this is episode 9 of the SI Media Podcast. Last week was Tom Verducci. Fantastic conversation. This week, another very accomplished sports writer in the sports media world. The guest is the senior writer for ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine, Wright Thompson. Prior to ESPN, Wright worked at the Kansas City Star and the New Orleans Times-Picayune, but his work at ESPN is what he is clearly well known for nationally, and it has been sensational on a variety of subjects, from Michael Jordan to Luis Suarez to Urban Meyer, Johnny Manziel, Dan Gable. Wright is one of the most noted long form sports writers in this country. He loves to talk about writing. I think he's going to be a really interesting guest, and I appreciate that he has agreed to come on the podcast. All right, without further ado, let's bring on ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine's Wright Thompson. Okay, and as promised, we bring in Wright Thompson, the fine senior writer for ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine. Wright, welcome to the SI Media Podcast. And let's start off with this. I think people would be interested in this. How do you determine the subjects that you write about?
It's a weird mix of things I'm interested in and some assignments. I try to accept assignments that are either something, especially if it's something I would never normally do or is sort of frightening, just because I think that's a good way to keep from sort of falling into a trap of only writing stories that perfectly fit your eye. For profiles, it's both people I'm interested in and people who I imagine might be dealing with things in their life, and that, at least in sort of, you know, theme or in, you know, basic thing they're struggling with that I might identify with, either myself or someone else. I mean, like, your very own Gary Smith one time said, like, I wish I'd have thought of this, but I'd totally stolen it. I think I've actually, I say this all the time, and sometimes I give him credit, and sometimes I don't. But, you know, all a profile is figuring out the central complication of someone's life and how on a daily basis they go about solving it. So I'm looking for central complications that I feel like I have personal insight into, because I think it dramatically informs your questions.
That's interesting. How much do you want to mix up sport, gender, age, different demographics between your profiles? Are you one who you don't want to do back-to-back football, or you don't want to do back-to-back men, or does it really? You don't care at all? Because
no, I've never. I don't know. It'd be interesting for me to go look. I have no idea what the breakdown would be. Like, it literally never occurred to me until you just said it. I mean, because they're all so singular, and like once they run, they're dead to me. You know that. I it's weird. Like you spend so much time on something, and then it's just over, and it doesn't matter at all. And only the next thing matters. So I'm very much, fully living in whatever the current story is.
That's interesting. I'll ask you what I asked Tom Verducci last week. Do you read your stories when they appear in either print or online in final form?
Sometimes. Usually not. Not because I'm avoiding them, just because they come out, and they've already come out to me by the time they arrive. I'll usually read them online when they come out, actually before they come out. I usually read the preview link just to make sure that, like, nothing got screwed up in the system when it was being transferred or anything, you know? But that it's a total proofread. I don't ever just sit down and read it. Usually just because by the time it comes out in the magazine, I'm so far into whatever's next that I don't care.
How do you know when a story's done? How do you know when your reporting is stopped?
I over-report. I mean, I'm working on something now where my editor was just like, you have to stop reporting and start writing. Like, so, you know, in some ways you're never done, you know? I mean, in some ways you just have to decide to stop and start writing. I mean, I'm reporting right up until the very end, plugging holes. You know, I needed a couple more details to make this better, calling people back, So I don't know. It's sort of fluid. Like I don't think there's any sort of set rule where you're like, aha, now this is done. I think it's pretty fluid.
You know, one of the things, right, you have an interesting job in that, you know, there's a lot of latitude clearly in the subjects that you can pick and profile. How much latitude do you have when it comes to deadline? Do your ESPN editors say when the story's done, send it? Or do they say, right, we're targeting this for this day, this issue, we need the piece by then?
Both.
Both.
I mean, you know, and by the way, on the same story, it can be both. You know what I mean? Like, I worked on that Ted Williams story that ran for years. But like, once it was in the cycle and on the schedule, now you're messing with other people's lives. I mean, it has to be in at a certain time so that, you know, you want to be respectful of everyone else who has a job to do around it. You know, I don't want to, like, you know, there's an editor who has to edit it. There's the whole, you know, fact-checking team. I mean, like, you just, you know, you want to be respectful of them and their time, too. So, like, once it's on the calendar, absolutely there's a deadline.
You've interviewed a lot of well-known people, whether it's Michael Jordan or Johnny Manziel or Dan Gable, and then you've obviously interviewed a lot of people who are not nearly as well-known as those guys. Do you approach your interviews in the same way, or do you approach your interviews subject-specific and why?
Well, both. I mean, you approach everyone differently, but not because of whether they're famous or not. I mean, there's no difference for me between, you know, 2 days with Michael Jordan and 2 days with, you know, a youth football coach in New Orleans. There's just none. Except that, I mean, and you look, you've gone out and done this. I mean, it's very much like if you're hanging out with people who have other people around them, you want to figure out sort of the chemistry and energy of the room, you know, and so like, just so you can match the either banter or seriousness or whatever it is, so that, you know, when you're with people, you fit into the group dynamic. So like, you know, so every single family and or group of people, they all relate to each other in a different way, and so you just want to be observant and figure that out so that you can fit in.
Do you have a favorite question that you like to ask people? Sort of a, you know, like a Bill Walsh, I want to ask these 10 questions in every interview, or are they specific to the subject?
No, it's totally specific to the subject. And I mean, you know, the two most common questions are, and then what happened? You know, or sort of, you know, it seems to me, based on what you just said, that A, B, C, and D. Is that true? And if not, why am I wrong?
You, right, you don't write every day. How challenging is that for you? And does it impact, in your opinion, how sharp you may be when you eventually go to write?
No. I mean, you write every day, you become dull. You know, I mean, I don't think it does at all. I mean, I'm much more sharp, you know, and chomping at the bit when it hasn't been a while than when I'm on day 16 of a grind. I did that thing at the World Cup.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, first of all, God, I forgot how hard it was to write every day. And it you do have to sort of like, you know, on day 26, you know, splash some water on your face because you just feel wiped out.
And the thing about your World Cup assignment, unlike, let's say, if you're at the Olympics and you're at a place for 21 straight days, you were traveling a lot for that assignment. So it wasn't just, you know, go to a press center and write. This was, I got to travel, and then I eventually got to find a story.
Well, and it was. Yeah, I'm never doing that again. That was a terrible idea.
But it produced a lot of interest. I think, if nothing else, it gave you, I mean, one, obviously, you got to see some amazing things, and two, the content was all around you. I mean, you went to the content as opposed to the content coming to you.
Well, it never comes to you. I mean, if I look around and there are a bunch of other reporters, I'm in the wrong place. B, whatever I'm about to do is going to be a single if that, and, you know, C, I need to move.
You mentioned that you didn't think there was much difference between talking to Michael Jordan for 2 days and talking to the youth coach in New Orleans. And I think people might find that surprising, given that Michael Jordan probably has been interviewed by millions of more reporters than the youth football coach.
That's a good, that's a really good point, because somebody like Michael Jordan, if you let them get on that's a really good point you bring up. You do have to be sharper, because you can have some false ball coach and get it back. But like with Michael, with the youth football coach, you can sort of have some starts, stops, and starts. But with Michael Jordan, if you let him get on autopilot, you're never getting him off. I mean, you ask one question that feels like a question they get asked all the time, and they're just sort of, you can almost hear them just, just like powering down and just doing it on autopilot.
I may be totally wrong here, but I'm always fascinated by Jordan just because, in my lifetime, he may be the most iconic, at least U.S. athlete that I've seen. Obviously, that's all subjective. But in the midst of interviewing Jordan in a one-on-one situation, he is a famously competitive person, one of the most competitive people probably that has sort of existed in his era. Is there any sense of competition with you as the interviewer to, if nothing else, kind of, not to be intimidated by him, not to give him the upper hand in the interview? Maybe I'm way off here, but does that dynamic exist at all, or is it just two guys talking?
No, it's just two guys talking. I mean, it's like, for me, I'm much more scared of getting all of this time and access to Michael Jordan and then choking.
Right.
Than I am of being in a room with Michael Jordan. I mean, the stakes for me I don't care about that. I don't want to mess it up. I'm much more intimidated by, there are very few chances where you get that kind of access and insight to someone who's that well known. And, there are not a lot of those stories that exist.
Right.
I mean, ever, and so, you read a lot of the old classics. I do too. So I'm versed enough in the canon to have known walking out of the room, oh man, don't fuck this up.
That makes sense
to
me.
I was much more concerned with that than I was with sort of, oh my God, that's Michael Jordan.
Yeah, that's interesting. So this hit the fact his celebrity and the fact that he doesn't always give up who he is puts more pressure on the story. That makes a lot of sense. And you also know, let's be honest, that if the story does hit, it's going to make a big splash. So
I don't care about that.
Yeah,
I
mean, but that is, you may not care about that, but that's a reality of the subject in that situation.
Well, that, my thing was, my favorite, one of my three favorite stories ever is Richard Ben Kramer's Ted Williams story.
Right.
And so they're, and the force multiplier of that story was Ted Williams' fame. There are very few chances, if you're, a sports profile writer, where you're going to get, you get very few swings at something like that. And so, like, honestly, I was much more concerned with not choking than, I was surprised at the reaction, frankly, because I just was so inside doing it that I didn't really stop to think about sort of what happens next.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of what it does is it, you sort of mentioned that before in terms of the multiplier. It just gives you a sense of just how famous Michael Jordan is. Do you consider yourself hard or easy to work with for an editor, and why?
That's a good question. Both. I'm a perfectionist, and I demand it of myself and sort of everyone else. But I want people to explain why they think something, and then once that's happened a couple of times, and then I trust them, I accept everything just implicitly. I mean, Jay Lovinger, Paul Kix, Chad Millman, J.B. Morris, Jenna Janovy. I mean, I'm just, like, they're people who, when they say something, they sort of, I feel like, I just trust them. That A, they know what they're talking about. B, they have sort of the story and my best interest at heart. And so there's a group of people like that that I just deeply trust.
I want to ask you a question about long-form writing, and I know you've done interviews on this. I know you've done other podcasts on that. You know, the word itself gets thrown around a lot. Some people then start mocking the word, which I feel like is a little silly.
It's pretty mockable.
I understand that. It can be, I guess, pretty mockable. Do you there's a lot of you know, again, not to tag everybody, but my hope is that people in their 20s and people in their teens, still as they grow older, want to invest themselves in long work, in long, richly reported profiles and features. 20 years from now, do you think the kind of writing that you are doing today will still be popular with that generation?
Sure.
Why?
I mean, every generation has always had a shorter attention span than the generation that came before. And yet, these kind of stories have existed from, you know, I mean, you go back to, I mean, Stephen Crane, you know what I mean? Like,
was doing those.
And, you know, Stephen Crane and Dexter Filkins, not that much difference in terms of aesthetic and, you know, an approach. And so, like, I don't know, like, it may be, you know, I don't know, it's an interesting thing, because, like, I just don't really care what somebody thinks about something. Like, I just, you know, I want to listen to on, you know, This American Life or Radiolab. I want to watch in documentaries, whether it's 30 for 30, or I just watched this great Bob Marley documentary. Before you called, watched this old documentary about Angola, or whether it's stories I'm reading, John Jeremiah Sullivan on Axl Rose, or Tom Jeannot on Falling Man, you know, or just any Gary Smith. I mean, it's like, I just want to read something that is deeply reported. And that's just my particular thing.
Do you, I'm not sure the last time you wrote something, let's say that's 200 words, 100 words, 300 words, do you get any pleasure from writing short?
Yeah, I mean, I do these television essays, which are very short and have to be very stylized. And so it's funny because when they're good, I think they're really good. And when they're bad, they're just stunningly bad. I mean, the ones I write. And so it's a very interesting and difficult thing to do well. So you're constantly trying to make them, you know, to take, I don't know, I mean, for somebody who hates baseball, I sure am making a lot of baseball analogies.
You did. I didn't mean to interrupt you. You did the shorts for the World Cup,
yes,
which were pretty interesting. Now, is that something that the television side of ESPN comes to you and says, "We'd like you to do this," or do you volunteer? Okay, so they approach you.
Yes, and every now and then, you know, it's a pretty good mix. I mean, they approached me on that. You know, I do some college game day stuff. And I sort of approach it goes both ways. I think I did two things for College Game Day last year, and one I approached them, and one they approached me.
Not that I want to sound like your agent, right, but I'm hoping that you are getting paid extra for that.
You know, honestly, I have no idea.
Check the paycheck.
You know what? I'm fine. You know, I sort of am a big believer in just, you know, like, I don't know how many, I probably shouldn't say this, but I have no idea how many stories I'm supposed to write a year.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, to be totally serious, that's also, I think, much of a ethos of SI writers and people here. Sort of, you know, most of the people are on staff are salaried, and, you know, if you end up doing 500 stories in 1 week, that's just the job. There might be another
week.
That's
just the way it goes.
Yeah, there might be another week where you're not doing anything. So I do understand that. That I read, I'm not sure where I read this, but you talked about that you had to write a lot of 1,200-word stories before you could write a 3,000-word story. You had to write a lot of 3,000-word stories before you wrote 5,000, 6,000 to 8,000. It was sort of all exponential. And I thought that was interesting. Why do you believe that? You don't think someone could, or it's maybe not, you think it would be tough for someone to jump from, let's say, 1,000-word profile to a 10,000-word profile?
Well, I don't want to, like, I mean, I'm speaking from what worked for me. I mean, I sort of think this is applicable to other people, but some people are smarter and or better at this than me. But for me, it was very helpful to, I mean, when I worked at the Star for 5 years and wrote basically a takeout every single Sunday, and I think I wrote one, maybe two stories that were longer than 3,600 words. One for sure, and I'm thinking maybe two. I don't remember. But, that was the thing. And so you really do, if you're writing the same length, there's a reason that if you cut and paste one of Gary Smith's SI stories, of course, this is probably the old bonus news hole too, but they're all like 8,100 words, 8,400 words, 8,300 words, 8,200 words, 82. Like, go pull them all. They're all the exact same length. And when you write the same length over and over, you begin to understand, I think, very deeply the structure of it and how stories fit together and, you know, how you, you know, have a character encounter an obstacle and be changed by it, and how you do it in a measured way that is both dramatic but not ham-fisted, and you screw that up a lot. And so it was helpful for me to do that at that length over and over and over and over and over again before I started trying to do anything different.
Do you miss at all working for a newspaper in the sense that you get to really throw yourself into a market and the subjects in that market, or do you think at this point of your career you want the national landscape and the local landscape would just not provide the same satisfaction?
You know, I don't know. I never thought about it. I'd love to work for the New Orleans Times-Picayune if it wasn't about to die.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know. I mean, I think to do a lot of stuff that I like to do, it would be very difficult to do without both the financial and sort of intellectual resources of ESPN. You know, I mean, I got really good editors and people to talk to, and I mean, really good editors, and that I can't imagine now doing this without them. That's the thing. I mean, you know, you're writing these stories. It's just different. It just is a very, very different place.
Is there a particular sport that you prefer to write about versus another sport?
No.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I mean, I'm much more interested in what either the story and or the character, but most often I'm interested in the place. So I'm much more interested in that than what the sport is.
Do you think there's
I really don't. Yeah.
I didn't mean to interrupt. Do you think there's a subject or subjects from a particular sport that make for better profiling than another sport?
No.
Okay, so you don't buy into the boxers make the best profile or
absolutely,
as a lot of people
not.
Might, stuff like that?
No. I mean, almost everyone's a good profile if you get him.
Have you found when you've written about men versus women, there is any kind of difference in profiling them? And if there is, what is the difference?
No, I mean, it's a Gary Smith thing. Every single profile is, what is the central complication of someone's life and how on a daily basis do they go about solving it? So they're both the same, and then every single one of them is totally different. And so, no, I don't think, you know... No, I really don't. I mean, I think everyone can be very, very interesting. Most people are interesting if you can get them to a place where you can, I don't know, figure out the story they tell themselves about themselves.
Right.
I don't know.
Is there one sport that you have not delved in as much as you would like to?
Not really. I mean, I'm trying to think if there's anything I wanted to go to. No, not really. I mean, I've never been to an Olympics, but I have no desire to go to an Olympics.
And that's interesting because my dream when I joined Sports Illustrated was to go to Olympics. That's interesting. Why is that the case for you?
Because they're almost, I mean, you know, Dan Wetzel crushes the Olympics. He does a very great job. Yahoo actually does a really good job on the Olympics.
They do.
But like most of the time, because I'm going through the list and thinking, well, Martin's good and Jeff Passan's killing it. But I don't know, man. I rarely ever read a story. I don't know that they're great stories. We're not a rights holder. And, you know, the mix zone, I don't want to go somewhere for 3 weeks and then just write horse shit. It just seems like I would be so frustrated to be surrounded by pathos that you know is happening, but you can't see and can't touch. and to know that you are surrounded by people who have given of themselves so much to be here that almost no one who isn't them or someone like them can even begin to understand what it is, and yet you don't ever see that and you don't ever touch it and you can't ever really like write about it in a real way. And I think I just would be monumentally frustrated.
Yeah, the one, you know, the sort of the best Olympic riders that have floated through here, whether it's Alex Wolf or Scott Price or Tim Layden, will tell you that you ultimately the key to get to what you are trying to get to is you have to get away from the Olympic structure. You need fixers to eventually get past that structure, and that's not easy. And it only
I love the Olympics. I love riding the Olympics before the Olympics.
That's interesting. I was going to say the only way you could really do that is if you work for an organization with resources to do that. You know, like the New York Times is very good at that. Yeah. Well, you've done stories where you've traveled to the country prior to the games, right?
Yes, I mean I've done that. The last two or three. I know I did in China twice. I know I did in. Where have the Olympics been? I don't remember.
To, Vancouver 2010, 2012 was London, 2014 was Sochi.
No, I didn't do any of
2008 was Beijing, 2006 was Turin, 2004 was Athens. 2002 was Salt Lake.
I did Beijing twice. I've done Rio a bunch.
Okay.
And no, I didn't do Vancouver.
London?
And I didn't I was in London, I know, cuz I did a big cricket thing. This is what happens, you know this. You write so many stories. I don't think I did London. I know we were talking about it because we had a story idea that for some reason we didn't do. And now I can't remember whether they killed it or I killed it.
You in a piece I read, you said one of your favorite pieces that you had done was on the Olympic wrestler and former Iowa State coach Dan Gable. Title that piece is The Losses of Dan Gable. Why did that piece stand out for you?
You're asking me to brag on myself, so I'm going to look like an asshole. But, I mean, I just felt like...
Well, you could say the piece sucked if you wanted.
You asked me about some other ones. I'll definitely tell you that. But that one did not suck. You always are striving to write a short story that's true, you know, that has that sensibility of a piece of fiction, except that it's true. And I thought that, like, this was both about someone sort of well-known, and yet it had, it felt like it had that quality. I don't know. I felt like the things that, I don't know, like the things I wanted to do with Manziel, I did with Gable. I don't know. I liked it. I don't know. I was proud of it when I filed it, I guess.
Did you find Manziel to be an interesting person, character, figure?
Yeah, for sure.
Why is that?
Well, I mean, you know, one day we're going to read a very interesting study about basically how fame makes people crazy. Because we're in the middle of the first generation of Americans who have grown up with this very particular kind of modern fame, and I just feel like it is deeply, deeply debilitating in a way that we don't fully understand, and someone in many years will do a very, very interesting, you know, we'll publish in the New England Journal of Medicine or something very, very interesting study about fame. So I found him to be interesting because he, you know, he wanted something, you know, like, you know, he wanted something desperately and then got it and wanted to give it back and couldn't. And I don't know, I thought he was fascinating.
Do you find that what you said about fame is pretty interesting? Do you find that it can have the same impact on sports writers and sports media people than it can on an athlete or coach?
Yeah, but I mean, very few of us are famous. You know, I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean,
depends on your definition of fame, I guess, too, right?
Well, yeah, but like, you know, most athletes talk about fame. I've been out in public with a lot of professional athletes, and no one turned their head. I mean, the number of athletes in America who were actually famous is actually pretty small.
Right.
So I'm, you know, I mean, well, who's a sports media person who you would say was famous? I mean, Stephen A. I mean, I guess if you have been parodied on Saturday Night Live, then you were famous.
Yeah, Bob Costas, Al Michaels.
Bob Costas is famous. Al Michaels.
Jim Nance. Someone walking down the street. Stephen A. Smith probably in there. Someone walking down the street, a city street, who would be identified by half the sports fans.
Chris Berman is famous.
Chris Berman.
Patrick is famous.
Agreed. All those guys. Keith Olbermann.
No writer is famous, I don't think.
Peter King, Rick Riley, I'm trying to think. Tom Verducci.
Not really. Very small group.
Very small,
you know what I mean?
Limited fame.
Yeah.
I would agree with that. You mentioned, the vortex of people growing up in kind of a new spotlight era. That brings me to something I wanted to ask you about, and that's Twitter. There was a time that you were on Twitter. You were semi-active, and then at a certain point, you decided to leave Twitter. I don't even know if you have a Twitter account, but I know you don't tweet anymore. Why did you make that decision?
I don't know, man. A bunch of reasons. I mean, and I'm happy to. It's one. All of us, including myself, are our worst selves on Twitter. And it was an enormous time suck, and even more than that, it was an enormous energy suck, and I just was like, I couldn't find anything beneficial about it, but yet there were so many things that were detrimental about it, and it doesn't drive traffic. I mean, all of our analytics say that it's totally worthless as that. I mean, basically, all it's good for is getting you fired, and so I just was like, and I also had zero impulse control, which is a terrible combination with that thing in your pocket. And so I just was like, I'm going to get myself into a lot of trouble. Basically, and so the thing that opened my eyes up, there was some guy who was cracking on my quote-unquote dead dad. And then, it's a long story, but then started cracking on my mom, and I sort of went bananas on the guy to the point that someone from ESPN called me and was like, "Did you threaten to beat someone up on Twitter?" And I said, "Yes." And they said, "Why?" And I explained it. They're like, "Oh, okay, that makes sense." And then I was just like, it just ruined an entire day. I had a lazy Sunday on my couch, and I should have just been watching NFL games. Instead, I'm stewing about someone who I've never met and was like, this is an insane waste of psychic energy. So I just killed it.
Did you, it's interesting because obviously I know a lot of the people who are friends of yours who I would imagine maybe tried to convince you to come back and not to let one person who...
Well, it's not one person. It's my own self-awareness of
right.
the fact that the person I am in 140 characters bears little resemblance to the person that I am around people who know me. And, like, why would you do that? Like, you know what I mean? Like... I just saw no upside.
What about the upside? And again, I'm not sure trying to convince you to come back.
No, of course.
It seems like a, kind of a progressive decision. I'm not sure I could do it at this point. But do you miss having writers you respect coming into your inbox without having to go through the hours of searching for their stories or their publications? Because that is a good service that Twitter provides.
It is, but I mean... You know what I found? The stuff I need to see gets to me. Especially that my friends know I'm not on it. People just email me links.
Do you ever anticipate a time that you'll go back to it?
No. And in fact, I don't know why anyone... I mean, I honestly don't understand why anyone would ever be on it, frankly. The company itself has never turned a profit, which I find is interesting because it's sort of like, why do I want to have something in my pocket where I allow people I don't know to yell at me?
We could have a long conversation on this, but the vitriol and that part is bad, but it does have the potential to get your work seen by people, even if the analytics are not as good as Facebook. It does get
Facebook analytics are huge.
Absolutely. It does give you the ability to interact with people who read you. So in that sense, I think there's value in talking to your theory.
My email address has been on the bottom of every story I've ever written back to the New Orleans Times-Picayune. I mean, I just don't buy that argument. I mean, we've always been unbelievably available for interaction, and people still email me and always have. I just don't.
And let's, you know, I know, I mean, interrupt you, and let's be blunt. And again, I think we're all, you know, there's a narcissistic factor to anybody who writes. It's an ego stroke, no doubt, to have people you know are reading you or to have people tell you they really like this. And I'm sure for a lot of writers and a lot of sports media people, that's a tough and I'm putting myself in this, that's a tough drug to kick. So in that sense, you were able to overcome, I think, something that is a characteristic of a lot of people in the business.
I have an enormous ego.
Right.
But, you know, and, you know, as all writers are, it's such an odd mix of arrogance and insecurity.
Of course, ego and insecurity.
This particular thing does not, that never factored into it to me.
Yeah, that's interesting. Twitter amplifies ego and insecurity beautifully. All right, that's interesting.
And did both for me.
And yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I appreciate you answering that. I'm sure there are a lot of people who are on Twitter, and I hear from those people who want you back, but I think I, at least if nothing else now, I have some insight into why you left and why you're...
And I like Instagram. You know, I'm not on Facebook. I'm not on Twitter. I have an Instagram account that almost no one follows except my friends, and it's fabulous.
You're posting photos of your travels or of your eating in Mississippi?
No, it's all... just travels and food. There's nothing sports related about it at all.
Nice. What's a country that you have yet to visit that you wish to visit either as a journalist or just as a person?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I've never been to Russia.
Don't go in February.
No kidding. Although, dude, if you're going to go someplace, you need to go to that place when it is fully itself.
Yeah, I've been there in February. It's cold.
If you're going to Russia, you should have to wear a big funny hat.
I think I've been to Moscow and Sochi. I think you'd like Moscow. It's a fascinating kind of crazy place that is very good for writers, but not the easiest to manipulate and not always the most friendly for Americans, but an interesting place and architecturally and culturally one of the most fascinating places on Earth. So that would be worth
going.
That
country was Vietnam until earlier this year.
I think I think you should go. I mean, whether a story presents itself, which I imagine a story could easily present itself, I think that would be interesting to you, especially since you've gone to China and some other countries that you would see some similarities. All right, a couple more here. How competitive are you with other writers on stories? Not necessarily the same subject that you're working on, but in general, do you read other writers and you're like, man, my story's got to be better than that story?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, very, probably two. Although some of it's healthy, I guess. But, I mean, I do read things and I'm like, okay, you know, bar raised. You know, I mean, I think in one of the great things about the ESPN magazine right now, which I think is, I mean, the magazine's just killing it, and it's a lot of it is they're a group of people who are competitive with each other, and so it's a certain amount of holding the rope. You know, you don't want to be, you know, no one on that staff is willing to mail anything in ever because you will look like an idiot.
Who is part of that group who's competitive?
I mean, everybody. Jones, Eli, Tim Kuhn, Seth Wickersham. Did you read? Did you read that story on Faker? The game, like, I love that story.
Oh, it's Mina Kimes.
Yeah, dude.
Yeah, really talented.
Dude, she's great. There is. I mean, J.R. Moringer. I'm looking at here. My issue just came. Let's see what do we got here.
Free advertisement for the competition. I like this.
Oh,
let's hope I stay on the air for episode 10.
This is it. I'm going to get you fired. It's finally happened. we're doing a lot of really interesting stuff. And it is, there is an esprit de corps that is palpable. And God, Brett Forrest is kicking ass. Oh, yeah. Scott Eden. Scott Eden's awesome.
Yeah,
he did the Yasiel Puig, his Tiger Woods story last year or 2 years ago. 2 years ago, I think. Still is like, you talk about, all right, you read someone else. I read that story, and I'm like, fuck, you know, oh my God, this is so good that it almost pisses me off it's that good.
Yeah.
So no, there are a lot of people doing really great stuff, and, man, it's challenging. Look, I'm working as hard as I can work just to sort of tread water with this incredible group of people who are writing for the magazine.
I always think that's...
that's like, you know, that's healthy.
I always think that's a sign of a good writer who reads something and they both admire it and it makes them sick at the same time.
I mean, you read Falling Man and you're like, but, you know, I am by some definition a decently accomplished magazine writer and I have no idea how Tom Juneau did that.
Yeah, this is amazing.
You know, I mean, like, I couldn't do that story. And so, like, that stuff, they're goals, man. They're things to aspire to.
All right, final two, right? You know, you've appeared on television and you've picked your spots on that, but I don't know if I've ever seen you on Pardon the Interruption or Around the Horn or the Sports Reporters. Why is that?
Nobody cares what I think about any of that shit. You know what I mean? Like, I don't even care what I think about any of that stuff. I sure don't want to subject it to poor viewers. I don't know, man. It's just not my thing. Like, I don't have strident opinions about stuff. I mean,
did you at one point in your sports career, or is that an evolution, or are you just someone who's never been, like, a kind of a sports opinionist?
No, it's just never been my thing. You know, I don't know. It just never appealed to me.
How much, if at all, do you fear getting written out? Do you ever worry, wake up, that one day the words just aren't going to be there, or just everybody's got their finite number of words that they write and you hit it?
Not that. I mean, it will happen to everyone. There comes a time when you aren't willing to do the work it takes. And so you see people do it, man. I mean, people who we all admire, who just... You hang in there for a little while because you just are a good enough writer to tap dance your way around the fact that you're just not doing the work anymore. Because and for 1,000 totally good reasons, family, you know, obligations, maybe you're just tired or you want to be home, and so you're cutting 2 days off of every reporting trip on one end and then both ends. I mean, it happens to everyone. So I'm not worried about being written out. I'm worried about sort of not being willing to do the work that I currently do now. And, like, I don't know, man. There will come a time when ESPN finds someone else to do this. And I just want to, I don't know, man. I would just like to be able to shake everyone's hand and say thank you very much. I had a wonderful time. I certainly enjoyed this. I hope you feel like you got your money's worth. Thank you very much. Like, I don't, you know what I mean? Like, I just would like to be able to walk out and feel like, all right, I did that as hard as I could for as long as I could.
If and when that happened, and who knows if it will, do you think you would then do something else, whether that's teach or something entirely different?
I don't know. I mean, it'll probably be something entirely different. I mean, I don't know what that would be, but I don't know. Again, I mean, I don't have some big grand plan. I'm very much about whatever the next story is.
Wright Thompson is an ESPN.com and ESPN the Magazine senior writer. You have seen his work over the years for both of those entities. He worked at the Kansas City Star for 5 years, New Orleans Times-Picayune as well. He's written some of the most memorable long-form sports profiles that we've seen in the last decade plus five or so. And you can find his work on ESPN.com and ESPN the Magazine. And I'm sure he's working on something right now as we talk to him. Wright, I appreciate you joining the SI Media Podcast. When I first started this, you were one of the guests I really wanted to get to come on. So thanks very much for the time. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's very kind of you. I appreciate you asking, and it was a pleasure.
All right, back in the studio with Bette Marston. And Bette, this is, I think, am I right about this? I did have Sam Borden on a couple weeks ago, but this is essentially the first pure long-form writer I've interviewed. I know Verducci falls into that, but he's known as hybrid now with a broadcaster. So that was interesting. I mean, you know, Wright Thompson's one of the best writers, sports writers in the country, maybe one of the best writers in the country. You shouldn't have to tag him as that. And that gave you some interesting insight into just how this guy is built and why he's able to produce the kind of work he produces.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it was interesting when you asked him if you think his editors like him. And I remember thinking that when we at the very beginning of this, that he is probably an editor's dream and an editor's worst nightmare. The
right.
fact that he doesn't stop reporting. You know, there comes a time when an editor's like, all right, hand the story over to me. It's my turn now. But he's probably one of those guys who keeps, you know, slipping in. Oh, here's another quote. Oh, I called this back. Here's update information, which is great, but also awful. I mean, if you're working in print, you got to fit the space. Sometimes you can't add that in. If you're online, you have unlimited space. But you know, same time, it's one more thing to go, you know, one more thing to fact check, one more thing to go back and edit. But,
you know, Wright's compared a lot to Gary Smith. And when I was a reporter here, I fact checked maybe 5 or 6 Gary Smith stories and others who fact check many, many more. And people love to work with Gary, but, and here comes the but, he was very territorial when it came to every single word in his piece. So that's, I think, what Wright is talking about in that, you know, Gary Smith generally had the best. One of the best line editors here working with him, and I think you had to have somebody who could challenge him a little bit back, because he was, you know, I mean, obviously the guy's one of the great writers of all time, but like every word, every comma, every reported fact, he had a reason for that. So I think when you're at that level, that is pretty interesting. I think you're right. On the one hand, it's a dream because you're dealing with the highest quality work that's going to appear in your publication. On the other hand, you're dealing with somebody who, like, if you make a change, that's not going to be an easy discussion per se.
Right. Writers at that level know that they're good and know that, you know, they think they're right. And most of the time they are. So sometimes as an editor, you just kind of have to recognize that and step back. But at the same time, you got to challenge them a little bit. You got to fight them, and you've got to, you know, make sure that – you know, that together you guys are putting out the best possible work.
Right. If you're an editor, to me, it's having worked with many of them, is if you believe the editor has your best interest at heart, then that's a good relationship. You know, you've written 1-2 sentence too many. Your kicker's just a little bit too overwrought. Your intro needs to be reined back a little bit. Like that, you know, you find the right editor, and then you got a great editor-writer relationship, and you can make some magic. Gary Smith's longtime editor, at least when I was fact-checking, was a guy named Chris Hunt, one of the better editors, long-form editors in the history of SI. All right, we wish everybody a happy 4th of July. If you're listening to this before or after, be safe. For my producer, Bette Marston, this is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network, the number one daily sports podcast network? Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.